Part 2. New Beings on This Earth. We will now discuss in a little more detail the struggle for existence. Charles Darwin, On the Origin of Species. Chapter 8. Princeton. These birds are the most singular in any of the archipelago. Charles Darwin, Journal of Researches. The more you look, the more you see. Peter Grant, Ecology and Evolution of Darwin's Finches. Mid-morning and mid-June in Princeton, New Jersey. Rosemary Grant is at work in her office, Eno Hall, room 106. She wears an Icelandic sweater, a long blue Laura Ashley dress, and sandals. Sunlight slants in the bay window behind her, through the spreading green arms of a katsura tree with shaggy bark. She is sitting on a Danish backless chair, at a table with wrought iron legs. This table runs the length of the room and holds a Casper GM 1230 computer, which is an IBM clone, a Hewlett-Packard LaserJet printer, a second printer, and a Macintosh 2 with a screen that would be large enough for a living room television. The Grants got back from the islands only a few weeks ago. Already they have transcribed every one of the numbers from their waterproof notebooks into the computers. Now they plan to spend a year without teaching, alone with all their years of records. "We won't be working," Peter tells people at Princeton. "Our purpose in taking this sabbatical is not to work with our hands, but to creep away and analyze our data." "Why do you say we won't be working?" Rosemary protests. "That's work." "Yes, in some ways that's the real work, and everything else is play." Rosemary runs her finger through the air above the tidy row of boxes that she and Peter keep shelved above the computer table. Charles Darwin kept his notes in 30 or 40 big portfolios, which he stored in his study on specially built racks to the right of the fireplace. Thanks to his powers of organization and his capacious mind, he managed to file and retrieve an extraordinary breadth and depth of information in those portfolios. But he could not have handled as much data as Peter and Rosemary keep in the rows of little boxes on this shelf, the archives of the International Finch Investigation Unit. Rosemary chooses a box, slips out a diskette, and pops it into the Macintosh. "Okay," she says after a brief search. "Here's 3425. Number 3425 is one of the two rogues that Rosemary caught half a year ago on Daphne's North Rim. He was the first of the two cactus finches that hopped into her traps. The rows of numbers on the screen summarize what the Grants and their assistants have learned of the fortunes of 3425 since that morning in January. "So far this year, he had two clutches," Rosemary says, speaking slowly as she decodes the numbers and letters on the screen. "And he had the same female for both clutches, 5582. In the first clutch, there were three eggs. Two of them hatched and only one fledged. In the second clutch, three eggs hatched, but again only one fledged. The drought is over, which is why 3425 has been so busy. The first bout of rain fell on Daphne in February. Within days, the portulaca flowered, and the torchwood trees put out leaves and filled the air with the memorable odor of their greenish-white blossoms. Tall grass sprouted and covered all the paths. Even after all these years, the speed of Daphne's metamorphosis still took the Grants by surprise. The finches bred and bred. Peter and Rosemary and this year's assistants ran up and down the sides of the volcano, trying to keep up with hundreds of nestlings, Darwin's latest finches. Then the Grants climbed down to the welcome mat and into the punga of a little local boat called the Flamingo to visit the finches of Gardner, Floriana, Genovesa, and Española. Just off the island of Floriana, the Flamingo's engine failed. An engine cable had broken, and the captain went below decks to repair it. The Flamingo drifted toward the resounding surf of a rock called Enderby. The swell was long and deep, and it pulled them closer and closer to the boiling surf and the rock. Rosemary, Peter, and Thalia stood at the railing, waiting for the engine to start, watching the rock get closer and closer. At the last second, the captain got the cable fixed and the engine started. Another season of precious numbers made it to this shelf in Princeton. Rosemary ejects the diskette from the Macintosh and loads another one labeled NES Total, 76 through 91. There is a long pause while the computer clicks and clacks, but the screen stays blank. "This is a big file," Rosemary says while she waits. 5,575 kilobytes, I think it is. A file that size could hold about 1,000,000 words, or the complete manuscript of Darwin's big book, Natural Selection, plus several editions of The Origin and The Descent of Man. That is how much information the Grants and their field assistants have compiled on the nestlings born to Darwin's finches on Daphne Major from 1976 to 1991. Abruptly, columns of numbers cascade down the screen and fill it from top to bottom. "That's why it took so long," Rosemary says, nodding at the dense little rows of numbers. "And this is just the start of the file." She scrolls down through the streams and streams of numbers. "Okay, here he is again. Our 3425 is quite an old male. These are all the times that 3425 has bred in his life. 1, 2, 3, 10 times. For the first time in 1982. Then he bred," she counts aloud, "8 times in 1983. That was the wonder year, the year of the flood. He bred again in 1984, once. That's about as much as anybody did in 84. Then he did not breed again until this year." With a few strokes of the keyboard, Rosemary can also locate all of the females that this old finch has mated with. The life and loves of 3425. Rosemary puts her index finger to her cheek, studying the screen. "He bred in 1983 with the same female as in 82, 7 times. But in the middle of the season he had another female, 4629. Like so many other finches in the flood year, he turned fickle and swapped mates. She died in 1987, and in 84 he bred with yet another female, 5538. She's also dead now." Peter pokes his head in Rosemary's door. In place of the black binoculars he wears in the Galapagos, a pair of black reading glasses hangs by a cord around his neck. He is deeply tan and dapper in a tropical khaki shirt. If anything, he looks even more like Charles Darwin here at Princeton than he does in the islands. Some of his colleagues wonder if he nurtures the resemblance. As if to deflect the suspicion, Peter has taped to his office door not one but two identical yellowing newspaper photos of a bearded Scottish bagpipe player. Peter looks even more like the bagpipe player than he looks like Darwin. "How's it going?" Peter stoops and glances at the monitor, which is still displaying the love life of 3425, with the running heads above the columns. Species, eggs, nestlings, fledglings, sector. He straightens briskly, without studying the screen, and pronounces with a positive pleasure, "I make it 10 fledglings produced over his lifetime before this year. And this year he produced 2, and none of those were recruits." "Oh, you have that in your head, do you?" Rosemary says. "I'm practically certain of it," says Peter. "Swapping mates didn't do him any good. Of all the fledglings he's produced, 2 of the 10 in 1984 and the other 8 in 1983, not one has reproduced. So this bird is a loser." Rosemary casts up onto the screen the lifetime batting average of another old male of the same generation, 2666. "He's been a good producer of fledglings, 2666, Peter says, this time without even looking at the screen. "In the region of 30. And some of them are still around and breeding, at least 2, maybe better than that." "He wasn't the most successful breeder, though," says Rosemary. "That was 720. Was it he, Peter? With 10 recruits? Quite an achievement." "Ah, yes, 720. God bless his soul. Rest in peace. The most successful of all time." The sun has gone behind a cloud now. A high of 87 degrees Fahrenheit is predicted for today. But in Rosemary's office, the air is cool. tote umbrellas and raincoats hang from a peg rack by the door. Otherwise, there is very little personal in the room. Only the row of computers, the shelves of diskettes, a great wall of books, a few framed portraits of cactus finches, and Nicola Grant's phone number taped to the telephone. Now that the girls are grown, Rosemary's role in the research has expanded. The first monograph of the Finch Watch, published in 1986, is by Peter R. Grant. The second monograph, published in 1989 and focusing on Genovesa, Rosemary's Island, is by B. Rosemary Grant and Peter R. Grant. "They work as a couple, they work as a unit," says one old friend. "The world would take much of what they do as Peter, yet they really do something that transcends either of them." That's developed over a long period of time, probably to a greater point than even they themselves are aware. Peter vanishes, then pokes his head back in Rosemary's door. "I'm setting up lunch, darling." But Rosemary keeps going. She calls up the life story of 5608, which was the other rogue finch on the North Rim that morning. The Princeton bird, banded orange over black. Another loser. But then, the losers are so much more common than the winners. "So," she says at last, "for any bird, if we want to know the dimensions of its beak, or who were its parents, or when was it born, or where was it born, or who were its siblings in the nest," she recites this list almost in a tone of incantation, "we have them all right here, four or five generations going right back." That is, four or five generations counting by lifespans, more than 20 generations counting by begats, a book of the Chronicles or a book of the Kings, all devoted to Darwin's finches. "Then we have the vegetation," Rosemary says with a little laugh, waving her hand at another set of little boxes. "It's all there. Here are the cactus data, for example." There is the Star Trek sound of a diskette ejecting from the Macintosh, and then the thunk of compiled cactus data going in. By pressing a few more keys, she can produce an instant graph of cactus yields on Daphne Major for the last 15 years. "And then the seeds, the yearly seeds," she says. "We have seed files across all the years up to this." Rosemary loads and displays one of these discs, an enormous file called Seed Year N. "Then, of course, there's rainfall, temperature." More boxes of diskettes. "And we have the notebooks, of course, and the day books." The day books are fair copies of the notebooks made in the evenings on the islands. She riffles one of the latest day books, pages and pages of neatly inked numbers. "And these are the songs." This morning, the songs of all these generations of Darwin's finches are neatly stacked on a table beneath Rosemary's bay window. Students have transcribed the songs from tape recordings using a machine called a sound spectrograph. The machine takes each song on the tapes and represents it in rows of thin, finely spaced vertical lines. Each picture is a snapshot-sized piece of white paper bearing a single finch's song. "We're getting them bound just today," says Rosemary, flipping through one stack of songs. She laughs again. "And so on, and so on, and so on. It all takes a surprising amount of time, but it's fun. As of this moment, every finch on the island has been banded but one. That one is right up at the top of Sector 4. He's been there for years. A terrible place, really horrible. Everyone has tried to catch him. He's right up here," she says, pointing to the spot on a map of the island. "It's very steep, going down into the crater. Impossible to put a net there. Also, he flies. He's a very difficult bird."